Okay. So, good morning, Professor Weber. Thank you very much for joining me. As we've discussed ahead of this series, the theme of the interview is the history of replica symmetry breaking in physics, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995. You've worked on structural glasses, so this is the work more germane to these ideas that we're going to be discussing. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you a few questions on background so that we can situate your contributions. The first
Okay.
one, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university?
My family, I was an only child. I grew up in Ohio, with a lot of relatives. It was a normal childhood. What can I say?
So where did your interest in science emerge from in particular?
Well, I was always interested in science. I was pretty much a loner. I would do experiments in my basement, and I had a fantastic chemistry teacher, and she basically would stay after school at night and let me run experiments. I mean, at one point I calculated Avogadro's number. And came home smelling like rotten butter. And my mother was like, "What did you get into?" I was like, "Oh, I just did a science experiment." So, it was and basically growing up in a small town in Midwest Ohio.
So, what led you to pursue chemistry studies at the University of Notre Dame then from that?
Well, actually, what happened was, like I said, I was originally interested in biology, and I had this great chemistry teacher, and so I decided to do that as a major. And I went, I guess, my freshman year at Notre Dame, and I was like, well, I think I really want to convert to mathematics. And they at that time at Notre Dame, every freshman had a if you had declared a major, they basically put you up with the professor, and there was a professor, and he said, "Well, why would you like to have a job at the radiation laboratory on campus?" It was a facility funded by the Atomic Energy Commission at the time, and so I started working there at the princely sum of $1.25 an hour. And got interested in computers at the time. And so basically what happened, although my interest in wet chemistry at that point declined, my interest in computers increased. And so I started doing calculations and stuff like that. So that kept me as a chemistry major. And I took at the time I took every graduate course in physical chemistry that the university offered.
So, what sort of computational resources were available to you at that point?
At that time, this was in the late 60s, and we had a, well, actually, it was in the early 60s, I guess. It was 1963, and we had a UNIVAC 1107. It was one of the supercomputers of that era. It filled a whole room, and I had a friend who was working at the computing center, and he had keys to get into the building and into the computer. And we used to go in after sometimes after dinner and play with the computing equipment they had there at the time.
So, and you'd gone to Notre Dame instead of, say, Ohio State. So, what was the draw of, what was it a natural school to go to in the Midwest?
My father was a Notre Dame football fan. My father never graduated from high school, but he before he died, he had gone to over 400 Notre Dame football games. And at the time when I went to Notre Dame, it was all male, and I was like, oh, I really want to I want to transfer to Ohio State. And my father looked at me and says, "Oh, you're quitting college?" I said, "No, Dad, I want to go to Ohio State." And he looked at me and we said this back and forth a couple of times. And then he looks at me, gets a sad look in his eye, and says, "Well, okay, Tom, if you want to pay for it yourself." So I stayed at Notre Dame. So I had many choices to go to college, as long as they were all Notre Dame. And I was smart enough that I got early admission to Notre Dame. So I really, it was kind of fated that I would go there. And I got a good education. At the time, the professors there really took an interest in the students. It's not like the environment today where they're all interested in doing research and stuff like that. It was more of a teaching atmosphere at that time, and it was a great fit. It was out isolated, and there was nothing to do there except study. And because I was too young to drink, and like I said, there was the Notre Dame campus is actually its own little city, and apart from everything else. And so that was it.
So from that, you went to study to pursue a PhD at Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
What gets you there? What interested you there?
Well, it was my research advisor. I was interested in quantum mechanics at the time, and Professor Parr was there as and he was one of the two it was one of the two locations. That's why I went to Hopkins. If he had he later went as a professor at University of North Carolina, and if he had been at North Carolina, I would have gone to North Carolina. I applied, I think, to graduate school at the University of Chicago because they had a great quantum chemistry group there, and Hopkins, and I got into both of them and decided that I wanted to pursue, basically go to Hopkins. But I basically went there because of the professor that I had wanted to work with.
So knew of his work from the papers, or you had met him at a conference,
Yeah,
or
yeah, yeah. I knew his work from research papers that he had published.
so what sort, I mean, were the computational resources vastly different from what you had had at Notre Dame, or they were roughly the
Yeah,
same?
they just they were basically less computational power. They were an IBM IBM computer. It wasn't quite as powerful as the 1107, but they had adequate computations for the calculations that I wanted to do.
After completing your PhD, you went to work at Bell Labs.
That's correct.
Drew you to a research lab instead of an academic position, say?
It was the only offer I had. At that time, I had a colleague who didn't get his PhD, and I got my PhD in 4 years, who didn't get his PhD in 4 years, and he ended up spending 10 years postdocing because jobs were really far and few between, and at that point in 1970, it was the there had been a huge hiring of students in academia at that time, and then all of a sudden all the positions were filled and it was almost impossible to get an academic job. And so I applied to a couple of different places, universities, got no offers because nobody was hiring, and Bell Labs offered me a position. And in retrospect, it was probably the best thing I could possibly have done because of I tend to have research ADHD in that I don't do any, I don't work in any one area for any great length of time. And so Bell Labs was the perfect environment for that. You know, we had a saying when they did the reviews every year, it was, what do you what did you do for us this year, not what you did for us last year. And you know, so I was able to move from subject to subject, work on silicon, work on glasses, work on air pollution studies, you know. And I mean, I think it shows in one of the papers I wrote, I wrote the simulation of polyethylene number one structure. And I had planned on writing another paper on dynamics. I never got to it because I got interested in glasses at the time and started working on those calculations. So I mean, for my the way the things that interested me in Bell Labs was the perfect environment for that.
So can you describe a bit the environment in the theoretical chemistry group at that point? And how free were you to choose your research projects when you joined?
At Bell Labs, you chose your research projects. I mean, I was asked to do one thing by management at Bell Labs, and that was the air pollution studies that Tom Gradle and Leonel DeFerro and I did. Other than that, it was a totally free environment. When you were doing research, you picked what you wanted to work on, okay? And you just went and worked on that. And then they, at the end of the year, they would evaluate you and say yay or nay, how much of a raise you got and things like that. And so it was a very free environment at the time. You know, it was also you didn't have there were very few workers there that had postdocs, so mostly we relied on our colleagues and we worked with our colleagues because we didn't have postdocs to do you know to assist in the work.
So, who were the senior theoretical chemists in that the group at that point in the early 70s?
Frank Stillinger, you know, basically Gene Helfand and John Tully, they had all been hired about 5 or 10 years before me. But you know, I don't really think of it as seniors in a sense. It was more we were all, you know, we were all on an equal footing. And if somebody came to me, for example, and said, "Would you like to do a study on, you know, this sort of thing or that sort of thing?" We'd say yay or nay and start doing the calculations. And I was actually the one who, you know, knew how to get the most out of the computers.
So, how did you get to know and interact with Dr. Sillinger in particular?
He was, I'm not sure. He might have been the department head at the time, but we were in the same department basically.
So you would see each
And
other every day, you'd have offices shared. I actually don't know what was the geography of Bell Labs in that sense.
oh yeah, we all had private offices, pretty much. And basically, we'd all go to lunch together. A bunch of us and talk about various and sundry areas. Bell Labs was also another very isolated, at least at Murray Hill, was very isolated. There were no, if you wanted to go out to lunch, okay, you'd have to get in a car and drive 5 or 10 minutes to a restaurant. So Bell Labs had its own cafeteria. They had long tables and, you know, people would just sit with physicists, chemists, mathematicians, engineers, and talk about various and sundry things. That one of the reasons I was able to do many of the simulations I did was I was sitting at the table complaining about the software library and the computer on the in the computer center because it was so slow and I couldn't really integrate the equations of motion. And Linda Kaufman was there, and she says, "Oh, I got this great software package to help you integrate. I'll send it to you." And they didn't want to put it in the library, but it's really fast, and so that's what enabled me to do a lot of the calculations that I was doing on the Cray computer at the time, because we actually had to pay for our usage of computer time.
Yeah, so the computational resources were markedly different than what you'd had at Johns Hopkins. Is that interesting?
I'm never quite sure what that, how we paid for computation at Hopkins. They had a computer, and Professor Parr had, I don't know how many hours of allocation of computer time, and we just used it. At Bell Labs, they tried to make the computer center as a not a profit center, but as a break-even center. So we had to pay for so much per hour. And actually, after midnight, the cost went down to 10%. And so I would wait up until 12:01 and submit my programs over the internet to get to be the first in the queue and to get my work done.
So in the late 70s, you became interested in inherent structures or structures obtained through rapid quench of the Gaussian core model,
Right.
and in particular of the
Right.
resulting amorphous structures that were ensuing. How did this question arise? And yes, how did this question arise?
Well, it actually arose because we were, these structures all have inherent crystal structures. And so what I was really trying to do is I was really trying to do basically a crystallization of the dynamics that had occurred. And so I started quenching these things, and that led to the interest of, oh, hey, this is we don't get the crystal structures forming or even crystallites or anything like that. We get these amorphous structures. So we started looking at those and looking at nearest neighbors and things of that sort, and realized that these were more like liquids than they were like glasses, but they weren't moving, so they were I'm sorry, more like liquids than crystals. And we realized that they weren't moving, so that they were more like glasses, and that's where all that work began. And we just became fascinated with the structures that were occurring when and we called these hidden structures and materials. And so every time we did a simulation of anything, we would after that we would look at the hidden structures that were underlying where we were right now.
How closely were you following the work of Raman, Mendel, and McTague, who worked on very similar issues at about the same time?
I wasn't, but I'm sure Frank was at the time because Frank had done some of the initial pioneering work with Anis Raman.
Okay, but you were not in touch with these groups. You were.
No, I was not. I personally was not in touch with these groups.
So, if I understood correctly your earlier comment, you were the computer specialist. You knew how to get this machine to work and be efficient. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, one of the things, one of our classic calculations is it's now called the Stillinger-Weber potential, and it's really interesting because somebody had come up with that similar form for that three-body potential many years before, but they never were able to do calculations because they didn't have the computer speed, but also they didn't have the what should I say, the cleverness to figure out. You know, you can either do a brute force calculation or you can figure out how to speed up the calculation. And that was one of the things that since I realized I was paying real money for these calculations, I wanted to make them as fast as possible. And so that's where Linda Kaufman's algorithm, computational algorithms, came into play. I used those, and those helped do calculations in real time. If you recall, at the time, people, when they did simulations, they were, you know, I can't remember the guy's name, the guy from Harvard that was a big simulator at the time, and I used to go to
Carpless.
Cal Karpless, yeah, Martin, and I used to go to a symposium and things and hear him talk about his calculations that he was doing, and they were like nanoseconds, you know. And it was sort of that was the way calculations were done at the time. And you know, when we got the Cray-1 computer at Bell Labs, we had the computational power, which was far superior to, well, almost any university at the time. And you know, we just went for it. And I remember I became very popular when I'd go to conferences because everybody would want to try to see if they could work with me so we could use the Bell Labs computers to do whatever, because they didn't at the time they didn't have the national supercomputing center, so academics were pretty limited in their computational power.
This effort on inherent structures eventually led to the description of a landscape of glasses in a science paper, Packing Structures and Transitions in Liquids and Solids, which you published in 1984. How did this landscape picture emerge from your studies? And was this a new idea at the time? What were the sources of inspiration in drawing, getting it
Well,
together?
I think, you know, I think it's fair to say that I don't know, maybe Frank would contradict me on this, but I just found that the structures were very, very interesting, okay? And they were something we just discovered when we went and did the simulations. And I At the time, I also had another effort to come up with some visualization software, and I used to make 3D 3D pictures of the structures and what was there, and it was kind of like, you know, in a sense, like a little kid looking at the landscape and say, oh wow, isn't that interesting? You know, I don't think I didn't have any preconceived notion of what we were going to find. We just did the quenchings, and that's what we found, and that's what we published.
How was the work received, this particular work in particular, at the
Oh,
time?
I have no idea. Because, you know, in 87, I basically left Bell Labs and went to the National Science Foundation, and I still did some research with Frank for a couple of years when I was there. But eventually, I decided, you know, I'm just playing. I'm not really serious about this, and stopped doing that. But you know, and so I got out of the field and did my career just went in a totally different direction. But you know, I got out of Bell Labs at a good time. I have very fond memories. You know, Frank eventually, you know, Frank, a National Academy of Science member, eventually got fired by Bell Labs because they were divesting of all the fundamental research that they did. They no longer did research, basically. And this was a result of some court decisions when the federal government said that Bell Labs is a monopoly. AT&T is a monopoly and we're going to break it all up. And so then prior to, when it was a monopoly, they basically AT&T and the telephone companies spent a certain percentage of their profits every year on funding research. And a certain percentage of the research that they funded was, a lot of it was geared to integrated circuit designs and things like that. But a lot of it also, a good percentage of it was just fundamental research. And so, numerous Nobel Prizes came out of Bell Labs. And it was just an environment where they put together a bunch of smart people and said, do your research, see what happens. And they let us have our head to do whatever we wanted to do.
So I'd like
You
to
won't find that in any research lab today.
take you back to 1984 when these pictures came out. I mean, one person at Bell Labs who had worked on amorphous structures and excitations in amorphous structures is Phil Anderson. So were you at any
Right.
point in contact with him or discussed with him your
Not
results?
really. Not really. Phil only talked to Area 10 people. And it's there was a hierarchy at Bell Labs. Area 10 was the pure physicists, and Phil Anderson was one of those. Okay. We were in Area 20. We were sort of the lesser grade because we were chemists and physicists, but mostly chemists in our area. And so there was that hierarchy, and didn't really associate with Anderson's group.
So, can you describe a bit the glass theory simulation community at the time when you were working? Were you at all participating in discussions or workshops on this theme, or was Bell Labs
I went to,
one thing to do?
I went to a Gordon conference, and gave the keynote speech at the time. But that was, like I said, I had research ADD, so I would go to meetings, and everybody would know everybody because they had been working in the same area doing the same thing for 10 or 20 years, and all of a sudden I'd be there as almost as an interloper, like, what is he doing here? And I mean, I went to polymer meetings, I went to liquids meeting, Gordon conferences. I became a member, a member of a fellow of the American Physical Society because of my work in polymers. So, and I did that for 1 or 2 years and then got into other areas. So it was, like I said, I had research ADD. I was sort of a dilettante, went from one area of research to another. And the link was computation on high speed computers. I mean, that was the thing that spurred my interest. Could I do a calculation? We did the first seminal calculation on air pollution. It was called the looking at the troposphere in New Jersey and figuring out that even if you took out all human forces of pollution, in New Jersey, you'd still have a problem because of the air mass that was coming over the forests of Pennsylvania, which was emitting terpenes in the hot summer heat, which then eventually produced ozone in the chemical reactions. So I went we went I went from one area to another and didn't stay. So if I had been in a university, I probably would have never been able to get a research grant because I never worked in one area long enough to say, oh, he knows what he's doing. I just went into an area, started doing research, got a couple of calculation results, and if my interests went to another area, I did something else. And Bell Labs, the Bell Labs environment was an environment that allowed you to do that, okay? Because they were basically paying me to do research, and I picked the area research.
So you nevertheless kept working on inherent structures for a bit longer. You notably looked at the hard sphere limit of inherent structures, trying to approximate
We
out the
never,
line.
yeah, we never, I never got into it in that area. I just looked at the, it started with the potentials that we were using, the Holtane potential, the Stillinger-Weber for silicon. That led to other things, but we basically started with the potentials and did the quenching, and so every time I did a calculation, I'd save a few of the results and quench them and see what happened. And so it was, it was from that we weren't doing, at least I wasn't doing the kind of the fundamental theory behind all this. I was just looking at these fascinating structures that when we quenched them on a computer,
You
and it was a discovery sort of thing,
proposed a lattice model for glasses also at about that time. How did this idea come about?
Oh, that was all Frank. I mean, that was basically Frank's idea, and we basically went from there to used our results to justify the modeling that we did. He was Frank was more of he had a knack for coming up with potentials but he didn't have the he worked on a desk calculator basically. He was not a computer person or although a lot of people thought he was a computer person because a lot of computations are ascribed to his work, but it was always somebody else knew how to run the computers. I mean, he could not he was not able to submit a computation job if his life depended on it. Okay, it just wasn't his interest, wasn't his skills. And that's why it was a great collaboration, because that's where my interests were.
So Glenn Fredrickson and Hans Andersen proposed an idea similar to your lattice model at roughly the same time. Do you remember
Right.
becoming aware of this effort?
Well, Glenn was working at Bell Labs at the time, as I recall. So that's probably where that came from. I mean, it's hard to, it's hard to say. Bell Labs was such a collaborative environment at the time. People worked with one another, talked about their research with one another. I always say the great secret of Bell Labs was that they hired smart people, gave them the head, let them do whatever they wanted to do, and they all ate lunch together, and we discussed stuff over lunch. Okay. And the lunch hour was often more than an hour because people would get in scientific discussions, start writing equations down on napkins and stuff like that. I mean, it was a very very congenial environment. And I used to go whenever I would visit a university and we'd go to the faculty club. The faculty clubs typically had these lunch tables that would seat four, maybe six people at most. Bell Labs had these huge, they were like grammar school cafeterias, these huge tables that maybe two or three would have been put together in a row, and people would just sit down and put themselves and were in any open space and we'd start talking to, whoever was next to us, whether it was, a physicist or a chemist or whatever, or a mathematician, you just found a place to sit and you started talking to whoever was there. And so, you know, what can I say? It was a great environment. It was a great environment at the time, where a lot of work was and ideas were discussed, and we used to have all these interesting discussions, you know, and people that would come to Bell Labs to give talks were really they were like, oh, they were really horrified because if a, somebody gave a talk and somebody would interrupt them. And I remember one talk. I think it wasn't Phil Anderson, but it was another one of the physicists was there, and he kept interrupting this poor guy that was trying to give the talk. And he'd say, "Well, if you would stop interrupting me, I'll tell you because I'll in 3 slides from now I'm talking about this situation." And he's the physicist shot back, "Well, if you don't talk to me right now about it, I'm leaving, so you're not going to get to the third slide." And so, you know, it was just an environment where people, I mean, I remember John Tully had had a picture on his door of a bunch of alligators, and he put a caption underneath it: "The Bell Labs audience waiting for the seminar speaker," as the alligators all had their mouths open. So, you know, we were a rough crew at the time, but we really, you know, people weren't afraid to put forward an idea, and among their colleagues, and sometimes the colleagues said that that's a bunch of shit. You don't know what you're talking about. Other times, you know, it would lead to something very productive. So, you know, it was a kind of a no holds barred environment. It was great.
So as you mentioned earlier, in 1987, you left Bell Labs for NSF and became a program manager
Right.
there. Did you ever get the chance to support research work on glasses or the glass transition theory or simulations as a manager?
I supported a lot of that work. I first went as a program director in chemistry, and so I was supporting computations in the arena. But you know, my second job at Bell Labs is I was in charge of the I became the division director for the Advanced Scientific Computing Program at National Science Foundation. And I was running the five national supercomputer centers at the time. So yeah, I su and then one of my later jobs, I was in charge of materials research and supported a lot of work on polymers, glasses, you know, that particular department was a blend of chemists, physicists, and engineers. And so, yeah, it was basically the materials department was really where I had found my niche in science. And it was sort of interesting because for years I thought of myself as a chemist, but later I said, you know, I'm really a material scientist because that was where all my interests, my computing interests, and my interests at Bell Labs were in the area of materials. So, yeah, it was a transition evolution, so to speak.
So we're approaching the end of the interview. Is there anything else you would like to share with us about this era that we may have missed or overlooked?
No, I think, you know, I think I really told you the environment. I think the key was you know, the Bell Labs environment was one where you could do things like this. You didn't have to, you know, write a research grant to the National Science Foundation and say, oh, I want to go and work in this area. And you know, one of the problems that I saw with the federal funding of science was that people, when they send it out to reviewers, reviewers would come back with, Why should we fund this guy working in this area of science? He's never worked in this area previously. And guess what? Most of my work research, I would have gotten that response if I had tried to get a federal funding agent to support it, because they would have said, well, he's never worked in glasses. He's never worked in silicon. He's never worked in air pollution. He's never worked in polymers. But at Bell Labs, these were assets rather than marks against you.
So finally, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in the Kimnik archive at some point?
I have no idea. I probably saved them somewhere. I have no idea where they would be, because after various and sundry moves, I got rid of a lot of the stuff. I have no plans on. It's only recently that historians have come and asked me questions about any of this stuff. I had a interview with a guy that's publishing on the silicon work, and he asked me a couple questions about a year ago. And but other than that, I all of a sudden I realized I'm one of the old fossils in science when historians want to know about anything. Never quite thought of myself that way, but that's the way it is, I guess. But it was just, what can I say? To quote a famous author, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times, it was the time that tries men's souls. Actually, that's the quote in the beginning of my PhD thesis. I always thought that line from The Tale of Two Cities was really great. I mean, it was just, I lucked. I basically, the only job offer I got was at Bell Labs, and it was the perfect environment for me, that it allowed me to do, to flit from one area of science to another, just discovering things and doing things. And, I'm really happy I was there at the time. Bell Labs, as I knew it, does not exist. Which is unfortunate, but hey, that's the way of life. I don't think that I think the United States is worse for the fact that research labs like that don't exist anymore. They don't, and so that's another reality. And unfortunately, I'm not sure the environment for funding produces the equivalent of these kinds of research labs, where somebody can just go and work from area to area and bring new ideas. And I think that's the thing. When we started doing a lot of the research at Bell Labs, we were able to discover things and bring new ways of looking at things in areas of science that hadn't been looked at before. It was a great environment, and I was really lucky to be part of it.
Dr. Weber, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, and again, my apologies for forgetting.